The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. Our first piece was published by the Associated Press on October 21 and written by Maria Teresa Hernandez, entitled, Violence Forced Them to Flee, Now Faith Sustains These Migrants on Their Journey Toward the United States. Tijuana, Mexico. Night after night for 6 weeks, Erica Hernandez knelt outside her home in central Mexico and prayed, Please, God, don't let my son turn into a criminal. I prayed a lot. I fasted. My faith was huge, said the 46-year-old woman, fearing her son would be forcibly recruited by a criminal organization. It didn't take long for God to listen, Hernandez said. By early June, after being kidnapped by members of the Familia Michoacana near Mexico City, her son escaped and the family fled north, hoping to cross into the United States. For many migrants like Hernandez, their faith has been essential for coping with their challenging circumstances. Hernandez and 10 of her relatives spent 3 months hopping on buses, taxis, and walking until they reached the Movimiento Juvento shelter in Tijuana in northern Mexico, where they are awaiting an opportunity to find a safer home in America. Before her son's kidnapping, the idea of migrating to the United States had never crossed Hernandez's mind. Her family owned cattle and several tracts of farmland. They had a good life. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said in early October that about 10,000 migrants per day were heading to the U.S. border. Waves of people riding atop railroad cars forced Mexico's largest railroad to suspend dozens of freight trains. While many places in Mexico provide shelter for Venezuelans, Haitians, and Central Americans, some shelters in Tijuana have seen an influx of Mexicans fleeing violence, extortion, and threats by organized crime. Jose Guadalupe Torres reached out to God as soon as he left his home in the central state of Guanajuato. His motives mirrored Hernandez's. His family was threatened by a drug cartel. We parted ways to be safe, the 62-year-old said, but God has always been with us. Now he prays for an appointment that will allow him to enter the U.S. Early this year, the Biden administration launched an online appointment system as a recommended way for migrants to request asylum, though thousands cross the border illegally every day. This is the precise time to preach the word of God, said Pastor Albert Rivera, an evangelical who currently provides a roof and spiritual guidance for nearly 400 migrants in Agape, a nearby shelter. According to Rivera, many migrants saw their children being murdered, suffered through the kidnapping of a family member, or lost everything to pay criminal extortion demands. We have received women married to hit men whose enemies have shot their homes and said, I'll kill you and your children, the pastor said. His guidance provides comfort for some who feel hopeless while waiting for a better life. Mariana Flores fled Guerrero, a Pacific Coast state, with her husband and 3-year-old son after organized criminals kidnapped her husband temporarily. She brought her faith with her, but said, being at Agape has renewed it. God did a miracle for us, the 25-year-old said. So even if we feel sad from time to time, attending services helps us forget, and we can keep trying to move on. Miguel Rayo, 47, traveled from the same Mexican state with just a few possessions, but keeps a Bible on his phone. I read it when I'm cold, when I'm in need. We want to be renewed and remain close to God, Rayo said. Agape welcomes migrants of any faith or ideology but everyone is encouraged to attend services on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays. Migrants also pray in small groups several days per week in their dormitories. A few miles away, Casa del Migrante provides spiritual comfort in addition to a temporary home, daily meals, legal advice, and mentorships that help migrants find jobs and schools for their children. "It's a lovely mass, a time to gather and share," said Alma Ramirez, who started working as a volunteer a year ago and recently became a full-time worker at Casa Migrante. The shelter used to receive only deported men from the U.S., but since 2019, when the surge of migrants increased, entire families and members from the LGBTQ+ community have been welcomed as well. "We currently have internally displaced people, Mexicans who left states in the South because they faced violence, mainly from drug trafficking," Ramirez said. Across the shelter's entrance, a portrait depicting the Virgin Mary greets the newcomers. "There are migrants who approach the door, and once we tell them, 'You can enter,' they reply, 'I knew, since the moment I saw the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, that all would be fine,'" Ramirez said. Both at Casa del Migrante and Agape, some migrants ask Murphy and Rivera to baptize them. Others request their company to pray for blessings. Many fear for the family members they left behind. Others hope for a good ending on their journey to the U.S. "Open the doors for me, Lord, so that I can cross," Rivera suggests they say in prayer. "Imagine the experience of faith," Rivera said. "Arriving at a place feeling broken, but then you pray to God, fill out your application, you get an appointment, and that's how you arrive in the U.S. That's something they'll never forget." Now an article published by the Religion News Service on October 18, written by Bob Smetana, entitled, "Want to Fix America's Woes? Start by Getting to Know Your Neighbors," researcher says. Author and researcher Seth Kaplan has some advice for Americans on how to address the country's most vexing problems. Get to know your neighbors. Then get to work making the community you live in better for everyone. Stop thinking that the best use of your time is to advocate for something in politics or advocate for something far away, said Kaplan, author of a new book, Fragile Neighborhoods: Repairing American Society, One Zip Code at a Time. Look for something close to home that you can do. You have to think of real people in real places and how you contribute to them. Kaplan, a professorial lecturer at Johns Hopkins University who studies so-called fragile states around the world, believes that politics and advocacy matter. But he thinks too many Americans neglect the community right outside their door, to their detriment, and the detriment of their neighbors. Humans are innately social creatures and have long maintained close ties to the people and institutions in their immediate communities. Today, Americans have largely abandoned that approach, instead choosing to form community through more distant networks of friends and colleagues with similar interests, often online, with less involvement in the place they live. That's one reason, Kaplan says in his book, that American society has become fragile. Beyond the home, we don't belong to place-based mutual aid societies, ethnic clubs, civic organizations, or religious congregations the way that our grandparents did, he writes. We don't have the kind of close-knit relationships with our extended family and friends that we used to have, or interact much with our neighbors, leaving many without a support system to call upon in a crisis. Far-flung networks have helped many people get ahead, Kaplan said, but it's rendered them materially rich and relationship poor. People in crisis are more likely to turn to a smartphone app than to a neighbor. That may help you for one problem or two problems, Kaplan said. That doesn't make you feel secure as a person. It makes you feel anxious. It makes you feel vulnerable. You're afraid to show people that you have a problem, and that's not a healthy way to live. Many religious groups in the U.S. have tried to adapt to a network-based social structure by abandoning a parish model of congregational life, replacing their houses of worship with close ties to community, with a consumerist faith that focuses on providing spiritual content, but not building a thick community, one where people bond deeply and share tasks and rituals. Worshippers instead get a sermon and programs they like, but aren't tied into a community where they belong outside of weekend services. Kaplan believes American faith communities have thinned out. For the most part, religion is very thin, he said. It doesn't think of itself as having a large community-building role. I think this is a mistake. It weakens belief. It weakens the sustainability of religion. Kaplan has both professional and personal interest in promoting place-based community. He has spent much of his professorial life in the broken places of the world, from Somalia to Bolivia to Sri Lanka, where governments are falling apart and humanitarian crises, conflicts, or catastrophes are commonplace. Ironically, he said, while those states are failing, their local communities are not. People often have deep social connections despite the chaos around them. Things are different in the U.S., he said. When people learn he studies fragile states, they often ask him about America's own fragility, given the country's polarization and disunity. Kaplan tells them that, yes, the U.S. is fragile, but not in the way they think. America has free elections, thriving business, ever-advancing technologies, and a higher living standard than almost anywhere in the world. America as a state is doing fine, Kaplan contends. America's communities are not. It's American society that is in trouble. From gun violence in Baltimore, to teens committing suicide in Palo Alto, to the opioid crisis in Appalachia, Kaplan writes. Our families and communities suffer from social problems that shock the rest of the world and ought to shock us. Family disintegration, homelessness, school shootings, racial animosity, skyrocketing cases of loneliness and depression, and deaths of despair, alcoholism, drug abuse, and suicide. Addressing the country's social woes, Kaplan argues, must involve rebuilding the country's neighborhoods and social capital. Religious leaders and institutions have a role to play in that work, but they need to build trust before they can build community. In his book, he profiles several religious innovators, such as Life Remodeled, a community organization in Detroit that grew out of a church founded by a pastor named Chris Lambert in 2007. Life Remodeled began refurbishing houses, assisting local schools, and generally bettering the church's neighborhood. By 2016, the nonprofit, whose staff was mostly white, took over a closed-down community school in the area with many black families and converted it into a community opportunity hub. When the deal was announced, neighbors reacted with anger, concerned that a group led by a white pastor and other outsiders had taken over a community asset with little local involvement. That led Lambert and other leaders to meet with local groups and began a slow but steady process of earning their trust. That kind of trust building takes time, said Kaplan. It would not be successful if no one trusted him, he said. It would not be successful if the people in the community did not have some stake and feeling of ownership in what Lambert was doing. Kaplan has also experienced the power of place-based community in his own life. He recounted growing up uneasy in a middle-class New Jersey suburb. His parents, who were Jewish but not practicing, were divorced, and he struggled socially at school. I had relationships that were characterized by mistrust, stress, and frustration, leaving me with an overriding sense of insecurity, he writes. And while my material needs were always met, I frequently felt socially uncomfortable, even vulnerable. As an adult, he found what he'd been missing by becoming part of an Orthodox synagogue and living in a closely knit community. It's a neighborhood filled with joy, he said, filled with friends and neighbors whose names he knows, and where people look out for each other in ways large and small. When a friend's daughter was diagnosed with cancer, he said, the neighbors rallied around her. When one of his kids fell and cut their chin, his wife took the child first to a nurse who lives nearby before heading to an urgent care center. That kind of support can't be bought, but only comes through human relationships. That's a lesson he hopes religious groups will remember, urging them to become countercultural by returning to their community-building practices. You cannot be like everybody else, he said. People of faith can offer not just a vision of a sermon once a week and a few services, but an alternative vision of flourishing that involves strong community. Now a piece published by the Religion News Service on October 20, written by Risha Karmakar, entitled, Vegetarian or Vegan? What about lab-grown beef? Hindus follow scriptures for diet advice. Animal rights activists and ecologically concerned citizens may have led the charge into veganism, a lifestyle that continues to gain prominence for its sustainability. But more and more, Hindus are adopting modern ideas about plant-based diets to the ancient principle of ahimsa, or nonviolence against all living beings. For me, being vegan was the best option to have the least carbon footprint, said Karthik Ramkrishnan, a construction manager who moved from India, the world's most vegetarian-friendly nation, to the East Coast in 2009. And spiritually speaking, I didn't want my existence to be dependent on any other species. Pew Research Center data from 2016 shows that some 44% of Hindus in India say they are vegetarian, and that Hindus with higher levels of religious observance are more likely to be vegetarian. Of Indians who do eat meat, which included eggs in the survey, many said they have at least some restrictions on their meat eating, abstaining on certain holy days, or from certain kinds of meat. The survey also found that most Indian Hindus say a person who eats beef cannot be Hindu. Cows are revered for their connection with Lord Krishna. Many small farmers in India own cattle for their family's daily dairy supply, and the presence of gaushala, or protective shelters for stray cows, is common throughout the country. But India is nonetheless a thriving market for both cow meat and buffalo meat, referred to as cara beef, and leather. More than 80 million farms contribute as well to India's dairy industry, one of the largest and fastest growing in the world. Living in this commercial world, people are disconnected to where their food is coming from, said Ramkrishnan. It has taken away any connection that humans had with animals, so they don't understand the significance of their lifestyle. The worst producers in the dairy industry, advocates like Ramkrishnan say, can unduly harm cows. We are separating these calves from their mothers because that milk is for those calves, said Nidhi Bansal, a plant-based nutritionist in Chicago. Bansal, a lifestyle coach, is the founder of Plant-Based Indian Living, a website dedicated to vegan, oil-free recipes for common Indian dishes. Bansal initially turned to the lifestyle for health reasons. Diabetes, heart conditions, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure ran in both her and her husband's families. Dairy is ingrained in our blood, said Bansal, who grew up vegetarian. Our cooking is loaded with oil and ghee, clarified butter. People could not believe that you could cook food, Indian food especially, without oil. In Ayurveda, the ancient scientific wisdom that stems from early Vedic Hinduism, meat is considered tamasic, heavy to digest and to be eaten sparingly, if at all. But dairy products such as milk and ghee are lauded for having unique nutritional values, providing ojas, or balance, to the senses and tissues. Roshni Sanghvi, a nutritionist, insists the myths surrounding dairy in India must be dismantled. Instead of contributing to strong bones and joints, she claims, milk can harm your gut and lead to more diseases in the long term. When I started, I was the only one, said Sanghvi, who lives in Bangalore in southern India. But veganism has grown so much in the fitness and aesthetic industries. You see a lot of athletes choosing to go mainly plant-based just because it improves their performance. Sanghvi, who owns a popular disease reversal coaching program, was the first vegan competitive bodybuilder in India. A Hindu, she notes that some of her fellow religionists, including Hindu leaders, have accepted plant-based food for health reasons, but still turn a blind eye to harmful factory dairy farming practices. I would be very careful in terms of communicating with clients with regard to why they need to stop dairy, said Sanghvi. I choose to stick to the health reasons. The moment I bring ethics in, people get defensive. Both Bansal and Sanghvi were raised in Jain families, a religion with the highest percentage of vegetarians in India. For Jains, the consumption of roots and tubers, potatoes, garlic, and onions, is banned to prevent injuring small insects and microorganisms in harvesting. But both say their families were shocked when they told them about their vegan lifestyles, worried the women would not get enough calcium or protein. Bansal said her friends stopped inviting her out, concerned about what she would eat. When you hear the word plant-based, you think it's plants only, she said. They think, how are we going to survive just eating salads and fruit? An influx of plant-based meat, such as the popular Impossible or Beyond Meat, has offered a new way of being vegetarian and vegan. The latest trend in lab-grown meat, made from the cultured cells of animals, is still being considered by religious authorities as to whether it is permissible under dietary laws or not. Sanghvi says she will likely never try those mock meats, as they are too similar to the texture and smell of real meat. I'm very grossed out by it, she said. I'm not even comfortable with mushrooms because it wasn't a staple part of our diet growing up. But for some Hindus, fake meat has been the answer to help a transition from non-vegetarianism to vegetarianism. I like the idea of having these things available to me if I ever feel like eating them, said Ria Shivakramani, a New Yorker who chose to go vegetarian during the COVID-19 pandemic. For me, it's entirely different. You're still eating something vegetarian that just tastes like meat. Shivakramani, who works in the beauty industry, said she made the switch as she learned more about the global impact of meat production on the world. In the years since, as she has pushed deeper into her faith, she has also found religious reasons to stick with vegetarianism. Having this belief of non-attachment, or Varagaya, with the food we eat, it's the biggest attachment we have in our lives, she said. I had to realize that meat or the food I eat is not directly linked to the happiness I experience. Shivakramani, who grew up in a meat-eating Hindu family, said carnivorism used to be a big part of her personality. Despite having to quit some of her favorite foods, such as sushi, she said going vegetarian was the best decision she could have made. Letting go of things like that trickle down into other aspects of my life, said she, who also quit drinking her beloved Coca-Cola. I became more particular about what I choose to eat and how I nourish myself. It brought some discipline into my life. Across the spectrum of vegetarians and vegans, many agree the options have become increasingly accessible. Ramakrishnan, for instance, uses vegan ghee and vegan yogurt in his traditional Indian recipes. But when attending temple services, which usually end in the giving of prasadam or offering, Ramakrishnans must say no to the milk-based treats that Hindus know and love. "It is a difficult position to be in," he said. Now he hosts dinner parties and vegan meetups across New York City, an effort he began a few years back to help others along their journey to veganism. "Indians consume a lot of dairy," said Ramakrishnan. "It's in the culture. It's part of the tradition and part of everything we do. It's going to be very hard to make that transition." And now a brief excerpt from an article published on October 17 entitled, "The Chosen Convention Brings Thousands to Dallas, Announces Theater Rollout for Season 4. Dallas. Over 3,500 fans attended the Chosen Insiders Conference in Dallas to celebrate The Chosen, the popular film series about the life of Jesus and his followers in first century Israel under Roman oppression. ChosenCon, a two-day conference, gathered fans from around the world, some as far as Australia and South Korea, to meet with the cast and crew, including actor Jonathan Rumi, who stars as Jesus. "It was overwhelmingly and beautiful to see 3,000 people in one room cheering and laughing and celebrating our show. But even better were the countless stories of impact viewers were able to tell us personally," said Dallas Jenkins, the show's creator, who told Religion News Service in a statement. "The show plans to release the previous three seasons of the series in more than 50 languages by the end of 2023, with an ultimate goal of 600 languages, according to show officials, which would make it the most translated film series in the world." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and pretty impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.